At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
In association with Viatel Technology Group, IT leaders breathe easy with Viatel Managed Cybersecurity. Viatel.com.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll find out what the EU's AI Act entails and just how long it'll be before it makes an impact. Tom Douglas is going to join me shortly with some photo editing tips for amateur photographers. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. You can get in touch at any stage. Email me techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. But we're going to start this week with the story that has utterly fascinated me and so many other people around the world. And that is the Mother's Day photo issued by Prince William and his wife, Catherine. You probably know all of the details by now, but there were a few very odd edits within the photo that led to some news agencies calling for the image to be killed. It prompted oodles of conspiracy theories, which we could and probably will do an entire show on some at some point. But the aspect of the story that I want to focus in on today is the editing. Tom Douglas is with me now. Tom, how are you?
I'm good. I am fascinated by this story.
Every element of it is interesting. Obviously, because we're news journalists, there's the kill notice that was sent out by the news agencies.
It's so rare.
So rare.
So rare.
And particularly for something issued by the royal family or put out by the royal family. Like, I've been talking to a few different people who said that the relationship between the media and the royal family is very delicate because the royal family can just cut somebody off entirely if they don't want them to have access or approval or whatever it is. So that's pretty unheard of. The minute detail in which this photograph was dissected and analysed is something that you'd only normally see like in a Hollywood movie about conspiracy theories.
Or, yeah, from a world leader who is, let's say, known for dodgy practices, maybe. From like the picture of Stalin appeared, where various people just disappeared. And it was harder to do back then than it is these days.
Yeah.
But harder to do well. It's still pretty hard to do well by the looks of it.
Yeah.
Because, as you mentioned, the kill notice from the photo agencies, the main issue the photo agencies seemed to have was what was with Charlotte's hand. I think it was her left hand the issue is with, because they're facing us, so she's on the right hand side of the photo, as you imagine it. Her wrist is kind of out of alignment with the rest of her arm, which is really jarring. But when you're editing a picture like this, it is common practice, particularly with kids, to burst and take 100 photos or 150 photos and take the best elements of each one. So like, you might have your eyes closed, or like wedding photographers are listening to this thinking of the painstaking editing that goes into a group photo of 100 people, eyes closed, people are looking away, people might be looking at one another. You would take the best elements of each photo and kind of jigsaw puzzle them together, which it looks like somebody did. The tweet from Kate Middleton said she occasionally
as an amateur photographer, she likes to dabble with editing or something like that.
But it didn't explicitly say she edited that photo, which was interesting to me. Like, I occasionally play with editing. Doesn't tell me I edited that photo. Anyway, you would jigsaw puzzle bits and pieces together. So Charlotte's wrist looked off. There was bits of hair that occasionally looked off. Somebody spotted a zipper in Kate's hair.
Yeah.
It just didn't fit. So it was like, as though, I'm surprised they didn't have somebody who was used to doing this, maybe a wedding photographer who's pro at this, to give it the once over at least.
But Tom, like, my point with this is, I technically fall into the amateur photographer bracket because I go out and about with my phone and I take photographs and I like messing with them and I like playing with, you know, silly little things, whether it's dragging the brightness down as I'm taking the image or playing around with the magic eraser on Google Photos or, you know, putting filters on things or editing and tweaking and all the rest. But I've never shared a photograph that I've edited in which somebody's sleeve is completely blurred. Or
you kind of look at it and go, that doesn't look right.
It doesn't look right. And even, you know, there's photographs from the Radio Awards last year where I tried to move like a big bottle of wine from the background of a photograph, but it made the tablecloth look like it was disappearing. So I just put it up with the bottle of wine. I was like, you know what? I'd rather put up something with something ugly in the background rather than having something dodging. So regardless of whether you're a princess or you're an average person, like, a common sense kind of comes into it a little bit. And again, because the thing is, this woman has just had severe surgery. She's got a lot going on. I don't want to do the pylon on her. I think the reaction to it has been bananas. But I also think it does draw up the question around photo editing. To me, it would almost be difficult to do that many bad edits in a photograph and put it out into the world. Than it would be to say, like, as you said, if one of the kids have their eyes closed, like, that's a normal thing that happens.
Yeah.
Why not just put that out into the world?
Yeah.
Like, why did you need to move a bit of fluff or whatever the reason was for the edit of the sleeve? I don't understand it.
Yeah, the palace obviously says she's recovering from surgery and we have to take them at their word. But the edits, they're so heavy and they're kind of, what's the word you would say, hack and slash edits almost. They're kind of unwieldy. They're a bit much. Like you said, like a mother and three relatively young kids, like it makes sense that one of them might be looking at something off in the distance or one of them could be pulling the other one's hair or, you know.
But they're all looking at the camera. And this is what I don't understand is that all of the edits that were done were pointless edits. And so, look, I can see why the conspiracy theorists have run with it because they're so bizarre. But anyway, let's not go down the rabbit hole because I think we'll end up here until God knows what time. But let's just talk through some of the techniques for when it comes to editing photographs. My default when I take a picture from putting it up, I'm like so bad for the magic eraser. I love the magic eraser feature because I can just circle something and
remove
it.
It does a great job, doesn't it?
It's so good. Now, it's good. I'd say 8 times out of 10, it's good.
Yeah, if you've got you take a picture on the street for Paddy's Day, let's say, and there's a drain cover in front of you, you can just remove it. And because the AI can see, okay, this tarmac is quite a similar texture all the way across, it can just copy what it sees and fill in that piece of, I'll go back to the jigsaw analogy. But this photo, it seems, was edited in a version of Photoshop, at least it seems to my eye, that doesn't have those AI features. It seems as though the EXIF data, which is exchangeable image file format data, which is the time, place, various different technical specifications that are kept within your photo. So if you've got an Android phone, open your gallery and swipe up and it will tell you this photo was taken by Tom Douglas in Marconi House on 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. That's the EXIF data, and different cameras will keep different levels of data. So this camera was a 5D Mark IV, which is a €3,200 camera new.
Spenny.
It's an 8-year-old model, but it's still an absolutely phenomenal, like, you still have pros using this full time. And a 50mm, I believe it was a 1.2, which is, again, a really spenny lens. The settings contained within the EXIF data that were seen by Sky News show it was 125th of a second at f3.2 and ISO 640. So 125th of a second strikes me as quite slow for people. The photo we saw wasn't middle of the summer. There wasn't that much light available. So maybe that's why that shutter speed was chosen. It just strikes me as quite slow because you can introduce a bit of motion blur.
Yeah.
If someone's hand is moving or if somebody turns their head quickly or if someone's hair is caught in the wind.
Yeah, if you're outside. Like,
it can introduce a bit of motion blur. I would have doubled or tripled that to freeze the action. Faster shutter speed opens the sensor to exposure for a less amount of time, which means you are snapping that moment and you're not giving it an opportunity. You're not giving the environment an opportunity to introduce blur. It just struck me as a bit odd. F3.2 is fine. They're all kind of on a similar plane with one another, so you don't need the depth of field to be too deep. ISO 640, again, it was pretty overcast. That makes sense. So in that case, you're kind of jigsaw puzzling edits. So let's say my jumper, I have a red jumper on me now and it's quite similar, the texture all the way down, there's no real pattern on it. Mm. If there is a bit of fluff on my sleeve, you could take another part of my sleeve that looks similar and transplant, copy and paste almost it onto the bit of fluff.
Yeah.
So it
masks it.
Masks it, exactly. That's a kind of recognised technique.
Yep.
And it just seems as though in this case it was done quite poorly.
But that's what I find fascinating, because I suppose I don't know Photoshop, right? I've messed around with it, but I'm not great on it. I've used Canva a bit. I've used, like back in the day, I would use things like Pixabay and that kind of stuff. But for the most part, any editing that I would do on my photographs, I just do in Google Photos, and I'd use whatever facilities are within that app. I have an iPhone, but I use the Google Photos app because I think it works really, really well. So, like, just talk me through. You take this photograph.
Yeah.
It's on your SD card or whatever it is. You hook it up, you put it into your computer, you're opening Photoshop.
Yeah.
Like, these, the edits, that, to my untrained eye, they did look like magic eraser used badly.
They did. It just, there was parts of it that just came out a bit blurry or a little bit, I don't know. Have you seen the magic eraser style edits where, like, let's go back to the drain cover on the ground, and it just looks a little bit smudged.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It doesn't quite fit with the... Now, in Photoshop, you can refresh. You can tell it, I want a different version of this edit with the AI features.
Okay.
I want, like, that's not what I wanted. I want a different version. You can press refresh and it will run whatever model it runs again. But sometimes, like you said, it just looks a little bit...
janky.
And janky. And when you're doing it with people, you're... viewer is going to notice it even more.
Mm.
Like, if I did a janky edit to a fence in the background of a portrait of me, you might not even see it because you're looking at the subject of the photo, which in this case was Kate and her kids. So you're going to see Charlotte's wrist. You're going to see the hair because you're looking at faces, and we as humans are so used to looking at faces, so used to looking at hands. That's like AI gets hands wrong, and you show somebody a bad AI hand and they're going to spot it straight away because they know exactly what they're looking at.
Yeah.
But you show somebody a bad, like you could show me a bad plumbing job done by AI and I wouldn't have a clue what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
It would take a trained eye to see it.
Yeah.
So everybody can see these terrible edits that are done by AI with hands or whatever. These ones with the Kate Middleton photo, a little bit more subtle in most places. The wrist was the most jarring one, but you just see them.
Okay, so if people want tips, and if they are amateur photographers or hobbyists, what are the do's and don'ts? And we'll rattle through these, and maybe we'll keep it between free software and then the Notion software.
Okay, the Notion software. Adobe, are you listening?
Correct.
Free software. I have the Samsung S24 Ultra. I went and picked it up after we spoke about it a couple of weeks ago. The editing features, they're quite simple compared to the Notion software, but they do the job. You know, you want to brighten a photo very slightly. You want to increase the contrast very slightly. You want to boost certain colors. You want to, I don't know, recenter it if you've taken the photo at a funny angle. You can use the horizon feature. Like, they're all quite simple, but they're all quite effective. I would say if you're editing something, don't go too heavy because it can be spotted a mile away. You want to get the photo right in camera, so your edits are quite light, almost. It could be like if you have a nice, imagine I have a nice big spot on the end of my nose. You could quite easily remove that because it's only a tiny little edit. And people who know me will know it's edited. Like, mom will say, "What are you doing?" Anyway, I keep them quite light. We'll go to the Notion software. If you want to learn Photoshop, the best thing you can do is go on YouTube.
Yeah.
Everything you want to do, every concept you could ever think of, someone has done or made a tutorial of, or somebody has said, this is how you might have to watch 15 minutes of preamble, but you'll get there eventually. They'll teach you how to use the individual tools. They'll teach you how best to use those tools within certain parameters. Like, Photoshop is, it's crazy. You can almost build like a tree of, let's say, spot heel tool, and then you've got hardness. How hard do you want it to be, and do you want it to feather with the surrounding parts of the photo? So do you want it to blend? They use the word feather. Do you want it to be on a new layer? Do you want to use the same layer? You know, do you want to create a layer to play around with and go, okay, I didn't like that, and we'll go back to the first layer because that's not the one that is edited. We'll go back and try again. like it just branches out until kingdom come, really.
The thing that I've noticed over the last few while, and we've had a few conversations now, like we had a conversation a few months ago about the ethics around using AI to edit your images. I actually find it increasingly difficult to do a bad edit of a photo. Because, and again, that's just using the free software that's in the Google Photos thing, because you can see straight away if like Magic Eraser or the blur tool or something like that, if it doesn't look natural, you just press the back arrow and it's undone and you get over yourself and that's it. So I think we're in a good position in today's age, and I know people will text in saying you shouldn't feel the need to edit your photographs, but look, we all need a hobby. I do think we're in a good position to be able to edit your photographs without making it look completely saturated or making the colours look weird or, you know, doing bad Photoshops that we've had for years. Like, do you remember a few years ago, the influencers who were like editing their bodies within an inch of their lives?
Yeah, I remember seagulls appearing in scenes that didn't quite fit.
Yeah. But like, I think we're in a good position now, aren't we, in terms of what software is available, depending on your skill level, your interest level and your financial situation.
Yeah, to go back to the ethics, it does leave a bad taste in your mouth as well, looking at elections coming up here, elections coming up in the UK, elections coming up in the US. But the European Parliament actually this week moved forward on rules around AI.
We're going to talk about it after the break. You worry. This is the whole point, though, because now, like, we're going to ask if it's coming in fast enough. But this is a huge issue because not only in terms of elections, but if you look at the celebrity culture that we're all living in 24/7, like I'm at the stage now where I don't really trust anything that I see online anymore because it's just so hard to tell if something's authentic or not.
Yeah, it is. It's impossible.
And it actually made me happy to see the kill notice from the news agencies to bring it full circle, because I thought they're actually looking for stuff like this and it can be caught out.
Yeah. And just to put emphasis on it, a kill notice is an extraordinarily rare occurrence in newswire kind of output. It means something is catastrophically wrong with the output, so it must be removed. Now, obviously, that sparks the photo going even wider than it would have. I hadn't seen the photo until the kill notice was issued. Kind of did the opposite effect. But yeah, it's so rare that an issue like that comes up, that a kill notice is issued for it.
Yeah. I would love to know what you'd think, not only about the photograph, but also are there editing tools? Do you bother editing your photos? You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. Tom Douglas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Now, you may remember our book club was here a few weeks ago reviewing John Ronson's So You've Been Publicly Shamed. We both liked it immensely. And Cameron Hill is with me now to pick this month's book. And Cameron, the pressure is on because your last book wasn't great.
That's not, by you two maybe, but I heard universally acclaimed according to some of the
emails that came in. Yeah. Yeah, we won't talk about that. Anyway, so you are picking this month's book. What have you chosen?
Well, I picked Small Fry, a memoir by Lisa Brennan Jobs, who is the daughter of Steve Jobs. So I'm listening to a podcast series on Steve Jobs at the moment. Mm-hmm. This book came up that there's the Walter Isaacson biography, and there's plenty of biographies out there about him. There's obviously the films with Ashton Kutcher and
Michael Fassbender.
One is better than the other, fair to say. But This is meant to be a really, really good, authentic look at Jobs in terms of his role, obviously, as a father, or not so much. Certainly, there's lots of evidence in the book that I haven't read it yet, but from outwardly, it seems like there's a lot of stuff about the neglect Lisa faced and her relationship with her father, her estranged father, and just in a very particular point of view on such a big figure in our culture, in the tech world obviously, but generally culturally as well.
Yeah, he's an iconic figure, there's no two ways about it. And I think what's interesting about people like this is that there's always public perception and public point of view, but getting the insights from a family member, even an estranged family member, is fascinating. And I also think Steve Jobs, since he passed away, he's somebody that was always flawed. And his flaws were you know, pretty well acknowledged globally by, you know, former employees or co-workers or whatever. So I think hearing this will be, or reading this will be pretty insightful. So give us the name and her name again, just so we have it.
So it's Small Fry by Lisa Brennan Jobs, and it's published by Grove Press.
Awesome. So if you have 3 weeks to read that, if you want to read along with us, you can email your thoughts, techtalk@newstalk.com. And Cameron and Kira will be here to review it in just a few weeks. Cameron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right, earlier in the week, further progress was made on the EU's AI Act. It's being painted as a significant step forward towards protecting Europeans as the technology continues to develop. Lawrence Vesey of CEO Partners is with me now to take a closer look at this legislation. Lawrence, thank you so much for your time. Can you just start by scraping it all back and explaining what is the very essence of the EU's AI Act?
Sure. Thank you, Jess, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you. So everybody's has probably heard about generative AI and ChatGPT over the last 6 to 9 months in particular. AI has been available for quite some time and in lots of different ways, which people would be familiar with in terms of either their predictive text, spam settings on email, and so on. So maybe not as obvious and high profile, but it's been there for quite a while. The AI Act that was voted on and signed off in the European Parliament yesterday, work on that started actually back in 2021. So it didn't happen overnight. Certainly the ChatGPT and everything like that accelerated the focus on it over the last number of months. And while the US and China had some legislation come in last year, the legislation signed off by the European Parliament is the most comprehensive international legislation that's been put in place to date. It is probably going to set the minimum standard globally, a little bit like GDPR did for data privacy going back about 10 years ago. And it is going to be very, very important for technology firms, both those that are providing AI solutions, but also companies and technology companies that are using and accessing the type of outputs that come out of those. Ultimately, it's intended to safeguard end users that might be influenced or subject to the outputs of technology like that.
And in terms of the classification and the categorization of artificial intelligence, because it is beyond just ChatGPT, what are those parameters? And will it be a case that, you know, if I'm on a team of five people, we have to abide by certain rules, even if our content is never going to be public facing? Or is it just content that does go out into the world that will be consumed by somebody somewhere on some platform?
Okay, so very good question. The legislation, it looks at safeguards under four different classifications. It sets out certain cases where use of AI is banned entirely. I'll come back to that in a minute. It then looks at for the cases where it is permitted, it classifies them as high risk. So that would require significant oversight, safeguards, risk mitigation, and regular review. And then areas of medium and lower risk, okay, depending on the types. So examples of areas that are banned, and there are specific areas like use of biometric and things like image recognition, it's banned. There are some exemptions for law enforcement, okay, they are quite specific. Examples of what is not permitted is things like social scoring, which happens in country like China, right, where people are scored based on their behavior and scored to 1 to 10. So that is banned. There's also bans on exploiting vulnerable users. So they're the areas that are banned. An area that would be high risk would be where AI is used in critical infrastructure systems. So for example, electricity generation, and distribution, also in areas like health systems and education systems. So they would be high risk areas. It is permitted to use AI, and AI can be valuable there, but it requires high level of testing and to give a level of confidence and safeguards on it. And then medium and lower risk areas, it obviously depends what the type of application is, but by their nature, there is a less likelihood of significant impact on either individual citizens, but also on wider society, democracy, and the environment and sustainability.
Okay, so again, there is good clarity there. What I keep coming back to in my head is that if I'm a business owner, am I going to have to audit every single thing that my business does and every single thing that those working on my teams do to assess and categorize, you know, how, when, why, where, and to what end they're using AI? Like, is this going to be incredibly cumbersome for businesses to try and implement?
Okay, so a couple of things. First of all, the legislation was signed off and voted on in the European Parliament yesterday. It has to go through some remaining steps. It's expected to officially be signed off at roughly the end of May before the legislative term in the European Parliament. It's going to take up to 3 years to fully come into effect. So first 12 months is going to be focused on the unacceptable areas, 24 months for high risk, and then 36 months for the medium and lower risk areas. So it's not going to switch into effect overnight, first of all. Secondly, it is primarily targeted at the large technology firms like OpenAI, Gemini, and so on, where they are essentially providing the platforms and the massive infrastructure of processing data, developing these models. Okay, so it's primarily targeted at those. A company, so a small, medium-sized company, even a larger company that is using those tools, they are using the tools. So this legislation is intended to protect those companies and to give those companies a level of certainty around the quality and of the outputs, and ultimately as end citizens, to give us as citizens and consumers of information a level of confidence and certainty on the data that we can rely on. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean that as a company using tools and technology, whether it's Copilot or anything like that in their business, it doesn't necessarily impact those ones there. However, it does mean that companies, particularly those involved in high risk type of activities, again, going back to whether it's utilities for energy, water, and so on, or healthcare, education, they have to be mindful that if they are using third-party AI technology, that they have to make sure that they're considering what are they using it for. Are those third parties, are they compliant, or are they on the way to being compliant with this new legislation? And also to look at their own internal controls and quality checks to make sure that they're still satisfied themselves with how this is impacting their business and how it is impacting the services they're delivering to their customers. So it, I guess to put in context, it doesn't mean that this is a scare story. And I think the second thing is that there are a couple of, this is not all a negative clampdown type of legislation. Okay, there are provisions here that are intended to foster innovation and intended to give access for small, medium-sized enterprises and startups, to give them access to open platform models. Okay, that these large tech companies on to give kind of a structure for doing that. And it should also promote, you know, one of the key concerns here of the world of AI is that, you know, at the moment is a little bit Wild West. Okay, and, you know, for both large companies and smaller companies, bringing in a level of structure, legislative regulation, and ultimately certainty actually is a good thing for companies, because it gives them clear parameters of what they can operate within and allows them to look at how they can innovate within that. So the headlines that probably everybody's listening to at the moment is around what this legislation is intended to stop doing, okay? or to control and to manage, which is definitely important. But there is also a focus here on recognizing that AI is here to stay and it's part of the future. And in the same way that, you know, electronic data has been, you know, part of our lives for a long, long time, and the GDPR Act was really looking to bring a level of certainty to data privacy and to bring in safeguards and ultimately consumer rights on access to their data. And in the case of the AI Act, it's going to be bringing in new consumer rights whereby they can understand the basis for decisions and can get clarification as to why decisions have been made or an explanation as to where the outputs of these AI solutions are coming from.
You mentioned the word innovation there a second ago, and I think that's something that some people might be curious about, because for the last 18 months or so, we've heard about how it's going to revolutionize work, and AI will mean that, you know, if it's embraced in the right way in your workplace, you could be freed up to work on more impactful work or the work that really matters. Are there safeguards in place to ensure that we're not putting, I suppose, the kibosh on innovation, and that innovation can still happen whilst being done in a respectful, careful way that's not duping or, you know, lying to anybody?
So that's a good question. So let's maybe step back and keep in context here for a minute, right? Artificial intelligence. The intelligence is not necessarily as intelligent as, you know, maybe people assume, okay? You know, there has been dramatic developments in it, but it's still very early days, relatively speaking, okay? And AI engines are really only as good as the training that they've had. They're only as good as the inputs that have gone into them in terms of quality of data and so on, okay? So if you have trained these AI engines on a poor, narrow set of data, it can only work within what it knows. Right. If it's been a broad set of data, it will be better, but it still has limitations in terms of common sense. You know, AI systems are not human at the end of the day. Mm. They don't really understand how the world works, and they don't really have empathy in terms of, you know, kind of the type of emotional intelligence that people has. It doesn't have any of that. And that results in, you know, you'll have seen, I'm sure, or heard different stories of daft results that have come out of different AI models. Google's most recent one, Gemini, had a load of kind of controversy over some of the images that were being generated about Vikings and Nazis and so on. And the interpretation of the data that it was doing, it was trying to compensate for one type of bias, and it ended up going the other extreme entirely. So, you know, I suppose it is important anyway, even if we didn't have this legislation, for businesses and ultimately consumers, you really have to have a certain level of skepticism around what these tools are. They definitely have a place to play as productivity tools, but they are not a substitute ultimately for good judgment that only people can do.
Okay, so I guess the headline here is that change is on the way. It will be disruptive over time, but it's a good thing. Is that the key takeaway here?
I think the key messages just are that change is on its way. It's going to take a period of time for this to fully take effect. It is going to ultimately protect consumers and protect consumer rights. And it's going to raise standards on the quality of output of these engines. That will ultimately be a good thing. I'm sure it will be challenged and tested in the courts throughout all of this. And I'm sure that even though it has been well designed to be as broad and general purpose as possible in terms of legislation, the pace of technology here is such that it will need to be updated, I'm sure, from time to time. But I think this should be viewed as in a very positive light in terms of what its intent is and what its end results are going to be. But it will take some time before it fully takes effect. So the type of objectives here around trying to ban, fake images, fake videos, and so on, that will take some time to come in. And I think something like half of the world's population are having elections this year or the next 12 months. This will not come into effect in time to stop fake messages going out on social media and everything else like that, which will mislead and have negative influence on people's decisions and so on. But that's ultimately what it's intended to do longer term. And from a citizen's point of view and from a democracy point of view, I think that's only a good thing.
Yeah, but I like that point now, when you just illustrate the timeline, it kind of makes me a little bit nervous, because 3 years to become fully effective, the world could be an incredibly different place by then. And if people are embracing this technology without the safety guards in place, will it be is the genie out of the bottle? And then can we get the genie back in the bottle if it gets further away from us over the next 3 years?
Again, good concern. A little bit like the analogy, best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. And the second best time is to plant one today. So, I suppose from a legislation, from a technology point of view, we are where we are. I suppose just to remember the 3-year timetable, the high priority unacceptable uses are being prioritized first. Okay. And that's, within a 12-month timescale. You're then into the areas that would take 24 months are lower risk areas. So by definition, they are lower risk ones. Is the genie out of the bottle? That's definitely a risk. But there are penalties and consequences for companies not adhering to this, and they are significant. Ultimately, the fines range from 1.5% to 7% of global turnover. So, that is a significant penalty, and that the EU will have the ability to fine these technology companies on. So I think the sheer fact that even before it takes effect, that it's in the public discussion is going to raise a level of awareness. And, your conversation today for your listeners, I think, is also going to raise the level of awareness for the general public, that we should be attentive and pay attention to what the outputs are in terms of AI tools. So, it is better that it is starting now than we don't have anything in process at all.
Okay, that's a nice optimistic note to leave things on. Lawrence, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thank you, Jess.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up in just a few minutes' time, John Fardy will be here with Screen Time. John, what's on the show this week?
Thank you, Jessica. Well, I have the great Jolie Richardson, star of things like Nip and Tuck and The Patriot. Too many credits to mention, talking about a role in Guy Ritchie's new series, The Gentleman. Also, there's a much talked about movie on Netflix, Irish Wish, starring Lindsay Lohan. I talked to her love interest in it, Ed Spellers, who's been muted as Bond over the years.
Like Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, he to an extent. And I'm also looking at the new Ethan Coen movie, Driveway Dolls, and the great Ed Smith of this parish on his favourite movie.
I love Ed Smith.
Yeah, very funny.
That's a lovely little show.
It's a lovely little show.
Have you seen Irish Wish?
Indeed I have.
Go on. Give us the goss.
It's, there's elements of... It's not terrible. There's elements of paddywhackery in it, but it's exactly what it says on the tin. It's... Mm-hmm. Lindsay Lohan, who's a great lead now in a rom-com, being visited basically by this Irish wish that will turn her life around, and she's going to marry the man she really wants, but she actually wants another. It's a standard rom-com. It does what it says on the tin,
Okay. Ever since the Oscars, I have fallen back down the Oppenheimer rabbit hole.
Yeah, I never thought you left it.
I haven't, actually, if we're being honest.
I think you're
here.
Still drowning in the dark.
Do you remember a few weeks ago when we were doing our little chatty and I asked you about actors talking about the process of the movie and do you enjoy it?
Yeah.
I could watch, and in fact I have watched, Christopher Nolan speak for hours about the process and appreciating why he shoots on IMAX.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen Oppenheimer, get it, but get the IMAX version. But also, when you see someone as skillful and as knowledgeable and as passionate as Nolan speaking, I kind of found myself getting suckered into the world a little bit further.
He is the greatest living proponent of cinema.
Mm.
He really is. And you're right, when he talks about it, like to me, and I'm glad to hear to you, it's almost spine tingling because he is so passionate about it and he cares so deeply about all his movies. And whatever the next one is, and it's going to be big, God help us, you know, you just admire the artistry of it. And you know, something like Tenet, I wasn't the biggest fan of. I thought it was too complicated. But you completely admire the level of effort, even if you don't like every movie. And I nearly like every movie he's ever done. But he is, as I say, just the most flag waver, if that's even the correct way of describing it, for cinema. Like he really is an enthusiast for it. And it's delightful to hear him talk about it. And there's other clips of him talking about The Dark Knight and Tenet and what's the other great movie of his?
Inception.
Because he like the stuff in that one is, again, I found elements of that too complicated.
But yeah, I'm so did I. But I think what struck me, one of the interviews I watched as early as this morning or as recently as this morning, he was doing like a panel with all the stars of Oppenheimer, and the interviewer was excellent because she was talking to him about appreciating the IMAX cameras, right? Mm-hmm. And he said one of the first things he decided to do with the story of Oppenheimer was take the CGI and computer effects off the table entirely, putting the onus on his head of effects to make them, like, they had to do these experiments to make it happen so that they could shoot it and obviously blow it up and make it look like ridiculous. But again, he is someone who understands and appreciates the skills and the talents of every crew member that you see on the credit roll.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible to watch.
And it's funny, I was listening to Sharon Stone on a Louis Theroux podcast talk about her time, and just these stories that come out from sets. And the story that comes out from Christopher Nolan's sets is just how good a boss, for want of a better word, he is to everybody in the, you know, for want of a change, the pecking order.
Yeah.
You know? He's just, because he cares so much about everyone's job in it, you know. And the thing is, it's great that he's had so much success, because Oppenheimer would not have been made had it not been for him. Because a lot of other directors, if they had gone and said, I want to make a movie about a guy who made the bomb and it's back in the 1940s in congressional hearings, they wouldn't get funding for that. But because it's Oppenheimer, or because it's Christopher Nolan, they say yes, and God bless him for that.
My final point on Christopher Nolan, and again, I could do the entire show about him, but I just kicked John across the studio there. In that panel discussion I watched this morning, the interviewer asked about direction from Christopher Nolan. And I always wondered, like, how do people who aren't actors direct actors? Because it's like, what do you know?
Yeah.
But Cillian Murphy told this story of, in a very intense scene in Oppenheimer, he came in and he was too hot. And Christopher Nolan literally walked up and said, he is a chess player, not a boxer. And Cillian Murphy just understood instantly what that meant.
Yeah.
He needed to dial it down and to be strategic. And I just think if you're in any way interested in movie making, you could do far worse things after screen time, obviously.
Yeah, I feel like I'm being preached
to. No, but I'm passionate about it. You know, when you kind of get...
I can hear the passion.
I love when I see people who are just masters of their craft.
Yeah.
And not only do they understand it, but they can articulate it.
And when he said to him, you're too hot, as in he was too up.
He was coming in ready for a fight. Whereas actually he should have been strategic. Like he's an intellectual guy. So he wasn't going to go head to head. He was going to go brain to your man's head and win ultimately because of how he thought and whatever. And I just think the ability to articulate things like that in such a subtle way.
Yeah.
And Cillian Murphy clearly found it a profound bit of direction because then altered his performance.
Spoken like a true movie enthusiast yourself.
Can I host your show, actually? Can I just do an hour-long Christopher Nolan special? John will be here in just a few minutes' time. But don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast right now as well if you want. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right, before we get to the mailbag, I want to tell you about a podcast that I have been hooked on over the last number of days. It's called Who Trolled Amber? And it delves into a very sinister undercurrent that was rumbling away when the court case of Amber Heard and Johnny Depp was ongoing last year. It's produced by Tortoise Media, who have made some excellent podcasts over the years. And it looks at the social media response to the trial and asks if a coordinated campaign of hate was orchestrated against Amber Heard. Take a listen.
A violent, predatory narcissist have when they are desperate to control their victim.
Your voice is gone, Amber Heard. Die, bitch.
The scale of the attacks was staggering. Between 2016 and 2022, more than 800,000 tweets were posted with the hashtag Amber Heard is an abuser. Only 15,000 tweets used the hashtag Johnny Depp is an abuser, even though she was the one accusing him of abuse. And that wasn't all. Tens of thousands of posts across social media called Amber a gold digger, a whore, and much worse.
I'm coming for you when you get out of court.
A lot of that hate came from real people. Johnny Depp has some really devoted fans, and they do not like Amber Heard.
Who wants to join me in my expedition to brutally murder Amber Heard?
But Daniel also noticed that many of the online attacks came from accounts that seemed less than human. Accounts with odd names, which seemed to be acting in a coordinated way, as if someone was controlling their movements, like the conductor of a giant orchestra.
Yeah, that's a snippet of Who Trolled Amber, produced by Tortoise Media, and I would highly recommend it if you are looking for a podcast. And as ever, if you have any recommendations for me, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. And a lot of people have been getting in touch on that email. Let's take a look at some of your questions. Jonathan has been in touch saying, "Hi Jess, can't find the recent program that you were chatting to PK regarding a mesh system. What was the brand you were recommending?" This is by far the most asked question I get. The Wi-Fi mesh system I recommended is the Tenda Nova MW3. This is a very affordable, very easy to install mesh system that creates essentially a Venn diagram of connectivity around your home, meaning that you're not going to have any black spots, basically. It's great and it's affordable and I would very much recommend it. Next, Angie has been on saying, "Hi Jess, I'm looking to buy a home CCTV system and I'm wondering what you would advise. I have a Google Home with a screen on it in my kitchen. Is there a system that would connect to that?" Yes, Angie, Google make very impressive, very high quality, very easy to set up again, home security, home monitoring system. It's a little bit pricey, but it does work very well and it would indeed connect to your Google Nest with the screen on it. So you can get indoor cameras, you can get outdoor cameras, you can get a doorbell. All of them are up on the Google website. So if you go to the Google store on a browser and if you look at the products, you will see all the different bits and pieces there. They are very easy to install. They connect via the Google Home app, which is the app that I assume you are working off with the Google device that's in your kitchen. So you just basically add extra devices, whether it's one camera or three cameras or two cameras and a doorbell. You just add them. The content is there. You don't have to sign up to the subscription service associated with it. You can basically utilize them for free once you've bought them. And I think it's up to 4 hours that you can watch back. So if someone walks into your garden, you can see in a 4 hour window, you get a notification first and foremost, or you can just scan through and see if someone has been there. If you want to get the full suite of videos stored in the cloud, then you do have to pay for that. But for most people, it's just to see if someone's in the garden and you're in the back garden, or if the doorbell rings, being able to check it remotely and so on. But the Google system is very impressive. My parents have it and highly rate it. So there you go. Final question for this week is from Johnny. He says, "I'm looking for a waterproof and fairly rugged phone at a mid-tier price point. The two I have in mind are the Motorola Moto Edge 40 Neo or the Nokia X30G 5G smartphone. I haven't tested the Motorola one, but I have tested the Nokia one. There's actually a video of it from last year up on our YouTube channel. If you go to YouTube and if you search News Talk Tech Bites, you will find my review. It's an incredibly rugged phone and we tried to break it and we couldn't. So I have tested that and I can stand over that it is a good phone. The Motorola one, again, on paper looks impressive, but I haven't tested it myself. So Nokia would be my preference. If you want to get in touch with any questions, queries, or whatever it is, you can email me techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram @JessKellyNT. But that's it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by GoLoud.